According to the Self-Storage Association, the country now possesses, as of 2005 anyway, about 1.9 billion square feet of personal storage space outside of the home. 1.9 billion square feet of personal storage space. According to a 2005 survey, the owners of one out of 11 homes also own a self-storage space. This represents an increase of 75% just since 1995, so in 10 years. Amazingly, as the amount of storage space required by homeowners has grown, so has the average size of the American house. In fact, the National Association of Home Builders reports that the average American house grew from 1,660 square feet in 1973 to 2,400 square feet in 2004. That's the average size now of an American home. So houses got bigger. We know that average family sizes got smaller. And yet we still need to tack on almost 2 billion square feet of extra space to store our stuff. Feel convicted already? It is affluenza, a term that was actually coined in a PBS special 10 years ago to describe the heart disease of affluent cultures, affluenza. They called it the bloated, sluggish, and unfulfilled feeling that results from efforts to keep up with the Joneses. John writes in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15, "Do not love the world." Do not love the world, nor the things of the in the world. And love means to be attracted to or devoted to something or someone. Love is a matter really of the heart, more than actually the possessions themselves. Some who have much do not love this world. Some who have little love this world too much. So it is a matter of the heart more than a matter of the hands. The world, now as John, I mean, if we're going to look at this command, and it is a command, then we'd best know what he means when he says do not love the world, because it's pretty serious. The world, as John writes here, is not the inanimate world of rocks and trees and mountains, nor is it the animal world of dogs and cats and other pets and animals. The world that John is talking about here is the world system. The world is the way of life. It is the way of looking at life without God being at the center of life. That's the world. So when John writes that we are not to love this world, he means that we are not to devote ourselves to the values, the goals, the activities, and the pleasures of this world system, this way of life where God is not at the center of it. So do not devote yourselves to the values, goals, activities, and pleasures of this world system. Now that is an everyday challenge for every one of us, because we all struggle with this one. Every Christian does. We have to live in this world. But we must not live for this world. We have to work here, but we must not let our work here become more important than God's work here. And that's a huge challenge for every one of us. And the attractions and the temptations are very real. So, if my house, my cars, my possessions, my toys become more important than God's church, and I don't mean this building, then I love this world. If my retirement plan becomes more important than investing in missions, I love this world too much. If my hobbies and my interests become more important than the spiritual growth of my children, then I love this world too much. And John commands us not to love this world system. As I was praying this morning, I was saying, God, this is really important stuff for us as Christians. And yet it is hugely challenging to my own life. How to live in the world, but not for the world. It's a command. Do not love this world. Why? Well, John gives us two reasons as we look at this passage. Why we should not love this world system. First, we should not love this world because the love of God is exclusive. Verses 15 and 16. Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. Now, I actually like the way Gary recited that particular verse. I think it was Gary doing verse 16. What was the translation, Gary? That was the NIV? Okay, I didn't look at the NIV this morning, but it really does make it come out for us in terms of what this means to love the world. You see, God hates our love for this world system. This is the love that God hates. John tells us that if anyone loves this world system, and he's very categorical, isn't he? The love of the Father is not in him. That's pretty blunt. God's love, or the love for God, and the love for this world are mutually exclusive loves. We cannot at the same time love this world and love the Father. Doesn't work that way. Love for God, then, is an exclusive love. We were created to love God. And we were created to find our greatest satisfaction, our greatest fulfillment, when we love Him. The problem is that we have come to conclude that you must love yourself first and find your satisfaction and your fulfillment in life. This is the message, the value of our world today, constantly. And even for us as Christians, it it gets us. Love yourself. Look out for yourself. Live for yourself. And find your fulfillment in life. Your happiness. But self-love is twisted love. Self-love will never lead us to satisfaction. It will never lead us to fulfillment. And many families, many individuals, even who claim to be Christian, pursue self-love and self-fulfillment only to find their marriages falling apart, their children pursuing godless goals, and their relationships ultimately unsatisfying. Why? Because self-love is really love of this world system, because self is part of the world. And love of this world will never produce lasting fulfillment in life. So what does it mean to love this world? John tells us, and he uses three expressions. It means that we are, first of all, ruled by our feelings. First of all, we are ruled by our feelings when we love this world. John lists three things that are of this world, and he says very categorically they are not from God at all. The first of these three things is the lust of the flesh. The word translated lust is not necessarily a negative word in the Bible at all. It simply means a desire, an attraction, a craving. It is a craving. It is an attraction. Sometimes that desire is a good desire in the Scriptures. Sometimes it is a neutral desire. It's neither good nor bad. And sometimes it's a bad attraction. So here the word simply means a passion or a desire that comes from our flesh. That is our human nature. It comes from our human passions, our attractions, our desires. And those human attractions are powerful, are they not? These passions, these feelings then, can lead us into the love of this world if we allow them to. When we become ruled by these feelings and these attractions that come from our humanness, that come from our human nature, the flesh, filled as it is with its own sin issues and sin tendencies, when we are ruled by our feelings, we are loving this world. That's what John is telling us. The passions, the feelings come to dominate our lives. Now, the fact of the matter is we are taught constantly to follow our feelings today. It's the big message that comes out in all sorts of ways, in our educational systems, in our work environments, in advertising. Follow your feelings. Our feelings, we're told, are the real us. But I want to tell you, it's a lie. Feelings are not the real you. They are feelings. They are attractions. They are real. But they are not the real you. They are just feelings. They are emotions. They are desires. They are attractions that may or may not be good at all. The biblical term, they are lusts and desires. Some of those feelings are good feelings. Some of those feelings are bad. Now, when I say something like that, there would be many in our world that would say, you're crazy. There's no such thing as a bad feeling. It's your feeling. There's no such thing as bad feelings. The Bible says, no, that's all wrong. That's buying into the world's value system when you say that. If you buy into that thinking, then you are in love with this world. You have bought into the values of this world. Your attractions will lead you to pursue the values and the goals and the activities and the pleasures of this world system. Feelings lead us to value what the world values. Because that's our flesh nature. A 2008 fitness magazine poll, just last month, of 1,000 women, found that women are willing to take rather drastic steps to reach their ideal weight, as society tells them. Now, how about some of these steps, ladies? 23% of the 1,000 women in this poll would spend a week in jail if they could reach their ideal weight. 23%. 23% would shave their head if it would help them reach their ideal weight. 22% would wear a bikini on television. And 21% of the women would trade 10 years off their life if they could reach their ideal weight now. 10 years. That's sad. That's sad. These are the values that the world says are important, not God. We're not talking about health here. Trade 10 years of your life to reach an ideal weight. You see, when we're ruled by our feelings, we come to those kinds of conclusions in life. With all of the problems that come out of reaching those conclusions, with all the consequences. Don't be ruled by your feelings. Let God help you rule your feelings. Secondly, love for this world means that we are stimulated by our wants. The second phrase that John uses to describe what is in this world system is the lust of the eyes. Now, once again, it is a word that means a desire, an attraction, a craving from the eyes, through the eye gate. What we see with our eyes becomes what we want in life. Now, the entire advertising industry in our world is built around this principle. Advertisers want to stimulate us to want something we don't have, so we'll buy it. Our economy is built on the stimulation of wants, primarily through the eye gate. Consumerism is the clearest proof that we love this world. Most of this stimulation comes through the eyes. We see, we want, we love. We even use the word love that way. I love that car. I love that restaurant, that food. We even use the word love in that craving kind of way. A comprehensive U.S. News and World Report article in 2004 revealed some statistics regarding children and consumerism and television. Researchers found that children, even very young ones, are targeted and influenced by advertisers. So 26% of kids age 2 and under now, 2 years old and under, have a television in their room. This is 2004. Advertisers spend $15 billion a year telling those two-year-olds what's hot. The average American child sees 40,000 commercials a year. And children recognize brand logos by 18 months of age. By 2 years of age, many children are asking for products by brand name. Whoa! The article also revealed that American parents do little to correct this trend. Instead, they seem to be encouraging it. American kids get an average, according to this survey, of 70 new toys every year. Must be what's going into our garbage dumps the next few years. In 1984, or maybe our storage bins actually. In 1984, children age 4 to 12 now, we're not even teenagers yet, spent $4.2 billion of their own pocket money. $4.2 billion. In 2004, they spent $35 billion of their own money, age 4 to 12. And in 2004, children were predicted to influence $670 billion worth of parental purchases, both small, which snacks to buy in the aisle, and large, which car to buy. $670 billion. No wonder the advertising industry targets children. That's a huge market. lust of the eyes, stimulated by our wants, even wants we didn't know we wanted until somebody revealed it to us. We are teaching our children to love this world and the things in this world in a huge way. So we love this world, John says, when we are ruled by our feelings, when we are stimulated by our wants, and third, when we are satisfied with ourselves. John uses a phrase here we translate, or the New American Standard translates, the boastful pride of life. The Greek expression is really more of an idiom than a literal statement. In fact, the Greek lexicon says that what it really means is the pride of our possessions or our position. So the pride of life is becoming proud of our achievements and our possessions, being satisfied with what we accomplish and what we have. Now, our world teaches us today to achieve so that we can enjoy the satisfaction of possessions and positions in life. And when we achieve something, we find satisfaction in our achievement. So, what do we teach our children? We teach our children to achieve in school and achieve in careers, be a success, and take satisfaction in that success. We pursue careers and we take satisfaction in what we can buy with our money and our positions and our success in the career world. Now, there is nothing inherently wrong with those desires in and of themselves. It's not wrong to want to do well at something, unless we are achieving our worldly objectives at the expense of God's objectives for us in this world. And that's a huge, subtle, but very important difference. We are training ourselves and our children to be achievers in this world, but not adequately training them to be achievers in God's work in this world. So the satisfaction comes from me, not God. Is it more important to do well in school or learn to love God? Is it more important to do well in our careers or serve God with our time and our money? You see, those are the kinds of questions that come up when we look at this passage. Very challenging, aren't they? If we are satisfied with ourselves, then we are not satisfied with God. And if we are not satisfied with God, we're in love with this world. We are not truly satisfied at all, however, because we were made to find our satisfaction in God, not self. It is not all about me in this world. According to a new comprehensive study by five psychologists, today's college students are more narcissistic and self-centered than ever before. From 1982 until 2006, college students completed an evaluation. Actually, 16,475 college students completed an evaluation on various college campuses called the Narcissistic Personality Inventory Test, the NPI. So they have the results of 16,000 plus students taking this NPI test from 1982 to 2006. And the inventory asks for rated responses to statements like this. In other words, you read a statement and you rate your response to it. If I ruled the world, it would be a better place. Agree, disagree, so on and so forth. I think I'm a special person. And I can live my life the way I want to. Now, the nationwide results over the years were quite telling, so much so that in recent years, they are saying that the tests prove that our culture is much more narcissistic, much more oriented around self, and our college students are as well. The study's leading author, Professor Gene Twenge of San Diego State University, by the way, this was not a Christian study at all. This is simply a secular sociological study. She said, "We need to stop endlessly repeating to our children, 'You're special,' and having children repeat that back to us. Kids are self-centered enough already." Now, that's not coming from a Christian. That's coming from a secular sociologist. The study asserts that narcissists, quote, are more likely to have romantic relationships that are short-lived, at risk for infidelity, and lack emotional warmth, and to exhibit game-playing, dishonesty, and over-controlling and violent behaviors, unquote. The researchers traced the phenomenon back through their testing to the self-esteem movement that emerged in the 1980s. They claim the effort to build self-confidence, self-esteem, has gone way too far. As an example, Twenge cited the lyrics of a song commonly sung to the tune of Frere Jacques in many preschools around the country. "I am special, I am special, look at me." That's enough. So from preschool onward, that was your entertainment for the morning, that's it. From preschool onward, we're teaching children that they are special. Now, is that bad? Wow. I guess so. Somebody didn't like it anyway. Current technology fuels the increase in narcissism, Twenge adds in her study. By its very name, MySpace encourages attention seeking, as does YouTube. Life today has become all about me. God says we're not to love this world. It is not all about us, because the love of God is exclusive, and God wants our love. And we will find true satisfaction not in ourselves, no matter what we achieve in this world, but in God. And the only way to find real fulfillment in our lives is to learn to love God first, because then all other loves begin to fall into place behind God. Secondly, John tells us not to love this world because the world system will end. It won't last. Verse 17, "And the world is right now passing away." It is disappearing. It is ending. "And also its lusts, its desires. But the one who does the will of God abides forever." When Apple's revolutionary iPhone hit the market in late June of last year, it sold for $599. I'm not going to ask if any of you have iPhones here this morning. 10 weeks later, the price went down to $399, a 33% reduction. While many who bought the iPhone at its original price, $600, were outraged, others would have paid any price to be among the first to own the new technology. If they told me at the outset the iPhone would be $200 cheaper the very next day, one customer explained, I would have thought about it for a second and still bought it. I had to have the iPhone. It was $600, and that was the price I was willing to pay to have it. Early adopters, consumers who purchase new technology as soon as it becomes available, relish the prestige of taking home a new toy before anyone else has it. Anybody here have gadget lust? I must admit I've succumbed to gadget lust sometimes, you know. Gotta have that. That's cool. Doesn't matter what the price might be. Doesn't matter that most technology people tell us that the second or third generations of that technology are usually more reliable or better. It doesn't matter the financial risks. The pleasure of owning a rare product far outweighs those logical things. In the words of one satisfied iPhone owner, even if it works for one day, it's worth it. For many, it's not the technology, but the distinction of ownership. One iPhone owner admitted to buying a Nintendo Wii game system for $150 above the retail price. Once he realized how rare the systems were, he just had to have that, so he'd pay $150 more than the retail price. He wasn't even interested in playing it, he said. He just wanted to have it. That's life in a land of plenty that still wants more and wants it first. We want our neighbors looking over the fence at our gizmos and our gadgets. We want someone else to experience the sting of envy. We're no longer satisfied with keeping up with the Joneses. We want to be the Joneses. All right, what is going to happen to the iPhone or the Nintendo Wii game system next year, year after, maybe even not that long, I don't know. Well, it's going to be obsolete, right? They will cease to have value because something new will come along. Technology will move on and the iPhone will follow the 8-track. I had to explain to my daughter what an 8-track was. She had no clue what an 8-track was. I wished I'd had one around so I could show her what an 8-track was. How many of you know what an 8-track is? Yeah, all the older people, you know. John tells us that the world system is right now passing away. Before our eyes, it's passing away. It is disappearing. What is of value today has no value tomorrow. The world empires that exist today may not even be in existence 10 years from now. The map is constantly changing. We have new nations becoming nations overnight. By the way, do you realize that students entering college this year, well, 2007 actually, this school year, freshman students entering college as 18-year-olds were not even born when the Berlin Wall still existed? They only have seen it in pictures, because it came down in 1989. The world is passing away before our eyes, constantly changing. The Wii game will be nothing in 2 years. So why love this world? That's John's question. When you love this world, you doom yourself to unhappiness. Literally. Why? Because you're constantly unhappy. You've got to have whatever is replacing whatever is gone. And that's what's happening in our culture. UNICEF surveyed 21. By the way, I was thinking the end of this week. This is like one of the easiest messages to prepare. You know why? There are so many illustrations. It's just like, it's constant to challenge our lives. Here's another one. UNICEF surveyed 21 of the most developed nations and measured how kids perceive their own happiness. Okay? Tight-knit nations like Sweden, the Netherlands, Denmark, and Finland ranked the highest for teen happiness, for feeling secure and happy. Where do you think the United States was for teen happiness? Second from the bottom. The only developed country that was lower than the United States for teen happiness was Great Britain. UNICEF's operating thesis was, quote, that stable, supported family and social relationships are far more important to kids' well-being than how much expensive junk they have piled up in their rooms, unquote. That's from UNICEF. William Falk of The Week magazine editorialized on these findings. He said, it would be comforting to shrug off the report as pure anti-American bunkum. That's an interesting word. But as a parent of a teen and a tween, I cannot. I've seen firsthand the emptiness that haunts so many middle-class kids. From an early age, they are taught that life is a pitiless pursuit of individual gratification and success, requiring above-average brains and above-average looks. There is no sense of context or community or higher purpose. In our rush to give our children everything, I'm afraid we have forgotten to help them answer a question that won't be ignored. What is this all for? These are secular writers. I'm not quoting from the local pastor. The Catholic mystic Henry Nouwen wrote, the great paradox of our time is that many of us are busy and bored at the same time. There's no lasting satisfaction because there never can be lasting satisfaction with something that's constantly passing away. John gives us the clue that he will explain more in this letter at the end of verse 17. How do we find lasting satisfaction? What is this all for? The clue is at the tail end of verse 17. And he finally gets there. But really, the rest of the book is about this right here. Verse 17. But, contrast to the love of the world, contrast all of that, but the one who does is doing on an ongoing basis, literally, the will of God lasts forever, abides forever, remains forever. That's lasting. You want to find satisfaction in life? Do you want to find true fulfillment that lasts beyond today, beyond tomorrow? You're not going to find it in this world. The one who does is doing the will of God remains forever. He or she lasts forever. Only what we do that serves God has any lasting value, ultimately, and therefore any true fulfillment or satisfaction. So to find true satisfaction in life, we need to love God and the things of God more than the world and the things of this world. It's as simple as that. And that John will develop throughout the rest of the letter. But it's nothing new. Jesus put it this way, seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Matthew 6:33. The principle is so basic, but so easily forgotten or neglected. Now, we're offering a Sunday school class, a DVD class. Gary Eaton will be leading it. I think there's still a sign-up sheet out there, isn't there? All right, this is a shameless plug. Okay? You want to learn about this? This will be a great class to take. It's from John Piper's book, Don't Waste Your Life. And I encourage you to sign up for the class because that is the very issue that he examines closely in that study. And he argues that we are wasting our lives today in the pursuit of worldly success. What makes you a success? Retiring and living in Florida and picking up seashells on the seashore? Here, Lord, see all my seashells. Well, there's nothing wrong with seashells. But where do you find success in life? That's John Piper's thesis. That's a wasted life, if that's all there is. And he argues that we are wasting our lives today, and we are teaching our children to waste their lives. In the pursuit of this world's stuff. And we're good at it. And that's why we're acquiring so much of it. And that's why our children are looking at us and saying, I'm going for that too. So you'll be challenged by a study. Sign up today. How many can you take? I know you'll learn what it means to invest your life in what really matters eternally. And there are so many creative ways that we can invest our lives in God's kingdom work. We think only in terms, perhaps, of, well, I've got to go to the foreign mission field. I've got to be a missionary. Well, obviously that's investing your life, but no, you don't have to be. In fact, there are so many creative ways to do it that it's only limited by our willingness to obey God right where we are. When I was in Indiana, there were two medical doctors that took this seriously. And so what they did was they joined their medical practice there in the little town that I lived in Indiana. And one doctor stayed and managed the practice, while the other doctor went to Africa for 2 years. And the money from the profits from the practice paid for that doctor's work in Africa. And then after 2 years, you know what they did? Flip-flopped. And the doctor in Africa and his family came home, managed the practice that paid for the doctor there to go to Africa and manage the practice there. They didn't even need to raise support. They were paying it themselves. Investing in God's kingdom. They were devoted to God and the things of God, not the world and the things of this world. Chiropractor Perry Hefty and his wife Arliss wanted to be in what they considered ministry. It was their heart cry that they be in full-time ministry for the Lord. For many, many years they prayed this way. One day when Perry was crying out to God about his deep desire, he heard as if God spoke to him, begin with what you have. And so instead of getting the $2.5 million he would have needed to start a healthcare ministry and retreat center, which was his dream for missionaries and pastors and other full-time Christian workers, Perry started doing what he could, giving free chiropractic services to Christian workers who were in financial and physical need. That was in 1994. Since that time, Perry's office has given away hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of services, about a third of his business, given away to help restore physical and often spiritual health. Many of the missionaries and Christian workers who came to the office were deeply discouraged, he says. But they felt they needed to put on a bright and happy face so they could raise ministry support. So we dedicated ourselves and our facility to being used by the Lord to heal and restore his people. They prayed for people in the office. They cared for people. They gave away a third of their business to meet those needs one by one. When they constructed a new office building in 1999, he and a prayer team prayed over the land, the building project, the business, the ministry, and every night he would come in and stay late and pray for everyone who was going to come through those doors the next day. Patients noticed the difference. They would often comment, "Wow, it just feels so peaceful here," Perry says. They still dream of full-time Christian ministry. They're in it. They've learned that God is happy to use them to minister for His kingdom, whatever business they're doing in this world. Father, teach us, move us to look at this week and say, what's important? What are the priorities that you have for our lives, where we are and what we're doing? And to invest ourselves in things that last, doing your will, because that's the only way that we will find true satisfaction in life.